Amos Fortune Free Man, Chapter 9, Auctioned for Freedom. With the aid of his neighbors, Amos had built his house before the winter snows came. It was a small house, like many others in the countryside, with a large central chimney and two fireplaces. At first, its furnishings were of the simplest, but as the tanning went on and the iron kettle again resounded with the coins collecting in it, Amos added to their way of living things of comfort. Feather beds and a writing desk, a chest of drawers and a looking glass, cheese presses and churns, a new wheel for the spinning and a larger loom. Now that he had had a barn of his own and cleared fields, he bought another horse so old Cyclops might be turned out to pasture for his remaining days. A cow and a heifer took their places in the barn, and to the tools of the tanning trade were added to the equipment of a farmer. Customers came to Amos Fortune with hides and skins from considerable distances. Men who wanted work well done thought nothing of coming from as far away as Reading and Sterling in Massachusetts, as Amherst and New Ipswich in New Hampshire. The reputation of the Jaffrey Tanner had grown steadily, and with a larger place, better equipment, and the hire of the Burgadoo boys, as well as his apprentice Simon Peter, who was indentured to him for a period of 3 years, Amos was able to take on more work. People trusted him, not only with skins and hides, but in matters of pounds and pence. One morning, Amos opened a letter and read to Violet, "Sir, please to let Mr. Joel Adams have a calf skin if mine isn't out. Let him have one of yours, and I will swap or allow you for it. B. Prescott." "Have you a calf skin?" Violet asked. Amos nodded. "One of the best." And he thought with pleasure of the large barn which enabled him to keep a good stock of leather on hand against such demands. There was another letter from Simon Butters asking Amos to pay Samuel Avery 12 shillings. "It being for value received of me," Amos read aloud. Violet asked, "Can you let him have so much, Amos, not knowing when he'll pay you back?" Amos nodded again. "We owe no one, and there are coins in the kettle like a family of rabbits in a burrow." He looked at Violet and smiled, the broad smile that meant more than any words. It was a debt of thanks he owed to her and would go on paying as long as he lived. She bowed her head slightly, accepting in silence what she knew in her heart was her due. Jaffrey had a social library, and Amos became a member of it. He read its books during the winter when tanning operations were somewhat in abeyance and discussed them with the citizens of the town. He was always well informed, for he subscribed to a newspaper. His store of information, matched with his ready wit, gave him opinions that were often sought after. He was their fellow citizen, Amos Fortune, and more often than not, the prefix Mr. dignified his name. He had won his way to equality by work well done and a life well lived. But his own life was no guarantee for the lives of those who were dear to him. Celindia, now 16, had many friends among the white children, but there were times when she was made to feel uneasy at school because of her color and her different ways. Violet, however, would not let her miss school. Violet knew what it was to carry through life the heavy burden of illiteracy, and she did not want Celindia to bear that along with the burden of her color. So Celindia went bravely to school, but she was happiest when sitting beside the loom watching Violet weave, or sitting at the loom and weaving herself. The better things went with Amos, the more his heart ached for those who received the necessities of life only in the form of a charity. The town had again been helping Lois Perdue with firewood and foodstuffs, but no matter what help she received, she never seemed able to rise above her wretched lot. The children went to school in tatters, and even when given new clothes, they would appear the next day with them dirty and torn. They could not seem to keep from falling down or tearing themselves on briar bushes. After years of ineffective help, the town felt that it could not bolster Lois Perdue any longer. She was giving warning that the two oldest children would be put up to public venue on the 31st day of December. Venues were auctions at which townspeople could bid for the privilege of affording care to the indigent. The lowest bidder would receive the contract. It was an expedient that pioneer towns had developed to enable them to look after their poor, and Geoffrey had been forced to come to it. Many of the people remembered the day in 1774 when the town meeting, a resolution had been passed, voted not to raise money for the poor, and of the human suffering that had followed. For there were always poor, either through misfortune or their own inability to contend with the hard conditions surrounding them. And something had to be done. No town could free itself entirely from responsibility, and auctioning off the poor was one of the means by which a township sought to meet its responsibility. Before the beginning of each new year, notices signed by the town auctioneer were posted in public places advising of the venue to be held. Celindia saw one such notice and told her mother of it. That night, Violet said to Amos, "So Lois has agreed to it at last. She's putting the two oldest up to venue." "Not Polly," Amos exclaimed. "Yes, Polly and Moses. But Polly isn't strong enough to work as hard as she'll have to if she's venued." "That doesn't matter to Lois. She can't feed the children, and the town can't let them starve." Amos would not believe what Violet had told him until he went to the village late on that raw December day. Then he saw the notice posted outside the meeting house. There were the names of the town poor, eight in all. Some of them he knew slightly, but none so well as the Burdue children. Under the list of names he read, "The above will be put to the lowest bidder, who shall board and nurse them in sickness and health, and pay every expense for them except doctor's bills, which the town will pay, and clothing which the town will provide. The contract shall continue 1 year from the first day of January 1793, when those persons who shall keep them shall remove them to the place which shall next be provided for them of within the town of Geoffrey, if within the town of Geoffrey." Amos shook his head slowly. He had not been able to keep away from the slave auctions all the years he was waiting on the arrival of a young girl from Africa. Here was an auction with which nothing could keep him from, since the fate of a young girl he knew well was at stake. It was a cruel cold day, that last day of the year, when Amos made his way to the meeting house where the venue was being held. The wind was blowing hard, and he pulled his great coat around him, tucking his chin down into the collar. There was nothing to see, for snow was on the wind and a blizzard obscured the mountain. But still, it was there, Amos thought to himself. He turned toward it as he came over the crest of the hill. Stalwart and deeply grounded, it was there. The winds raged around it and snow battered against it. The knowledge of its presence gave back to him some of the strength that the wind had taken from him in his walk against it up the long hill. Entering the meeting house, he slipped quietly into a seat at the rear, hoping to be unobserved. But all who were gathered there knew someone had entered, for the gust of cold wind that came through the door. Amos looked over the heads of the people at the eight luckless ones, the poor of the year, who were to be dispatched, sitting fearful and silent in a group near the auctioneer. It was a strange kind of auction, this venue, for there was no talk and only a little whispering among the townspeople who were present. Some of them looked shamefaced, knowing they were out to get labor in the cheapest way. Others boldly intended bidding an elderly people so they might make a few pounds off the town. All were surprised to see the tanner enter. Amos Fortune's reputation for fair dealing was such that none could think of him as taking part in a venue. Lois Perdue sat in a corner, huddled into her thin garments, sobbing pitifully. When Amos saw where she was, he moved over and sat beside her, stroking her hands for comfort and assurance. The auctioneer started to address the small gathering of people, calling out his wares as if he had so much livestock at his disposal. The first to be auctioned was a 14-year-old Negro girl. "She may be thin," he said, "but she won't cost you much to keep if she eats little. She's got a good pair of arms, and those legs would carry her as far as anyone here is likely to go. What am I bid?" His eyes range over the crowd, hopefully. Alexander Milliken of the tavern on the slope on the mountain bid £4. Lois Perdue shuddered. No, she murmured. "Not a tavern." Amos whispered into her ear, "It's the last bid that matters, not the first." There were other bids, but none went lower than £2, 10 shillings. People nodded their heads as if in agreement, for who could keep a girl in food for a year for less than that? In spite of what the auctioneer had said about the stoutness of her limbs, it was clear to see that little work could be got from a girl as thin as a child with a dazed look in her eyes and racking cough. "Going," the auctioneer called out. "Going? £1.16, Amos Fortune spoke up in a voice that was clear and strong and known to so many. The auctioneer gasped. A ripple of amazement ran through the group of people in the meeting house. "You must like your town to want to save it so much money," the auctioneer commented. "Going, going," he said, then a loud voice, "Gone, Mr. Amos Fortune. Polly Perdue, 1 year at £1.16. Polly left the huddled cluster of the poor and ran over to her mother and Amos, turning from one to the other, still too frightened to smile at the good fortune that had come to her. None of the others went so cheap. John Brainett got the care of Widow Combs at £5.18. Joseph Wilder got the Widow Cutter at £10.16. But the Widow Cutter was lame and so old that would be nothing but the chimney corner for her. 12-year-old Moses Perdue was struck off to Joseph Stewart, the first and only bidder from that day until he was 21 at £15.15. Have to be paid at the end of 1 year, and if he lived the other half, to be paid at the end of the second year. Joseph Stewart knew the boy had gotten work from him, He was a hard man, but the boy was like a colt and could profit from a firm hand. "Likely his back will be sore from the beatings he'll be getting," Lois said. "And perhaps they will do something to his soul," Amos reminded her, for he knew the boy too. "Wings can't grow without a little suffering." Violet might have small sympathy for the shiftless Lois, but she readily took Polly to her heart, outfitting her in Celindia's clothes and teaching her some of the duties about the house. Celindia and Polly were near the same age, and Celindia embraced her new sister warmly. But beyond the flight of a smile across Polly's dark face and a few words, she seemed bowed forever by her lot. When she sat dreaming by the fire, Amos would sometimes call to her to break her from a long reverie, and she would shake her head and blink her eyes with a start. "Yes, Uncle Amos," she would say, eager to do his bidding. But even if he asked her, she could not say where her thoughts had been and been the while she had been dreaming. Polly tried to be a help to Violet in the work of the house, but dusting cloth or broom had a way of falling from her hands. Violet would come upon her standing still and staring before her, the task she had been given to do still undone. Polly was eager to work at the loom, and Celindia spent hours showing her its simple mysteries. But as soon as Polly endeavored to do the work herself, her hands would slide off the shuttle, her feet would lose their hold on the treadles, and her eyes would stare before her. "What do you think about all the time?" Celindia asked. But Polly could never say. Violet, in exasperation at a simple task undone, exclaimed to Amos, "It's only your kindness that keeps her, Amos Fortune, for anyone else would have returned her to the town long ago." He smiled in answer. What he had been done with good reason, and he was satisfied. Polly liked going to school with Celindia, but after a few days she brought back a note saying there was nothing the school could do for her since she would not learn. That evening, Amos, with a piece of leather large enough for a jerkin and fine enough for a gentleman, went to see the schoolteacher. He offered the leather as a gift and begged leniency for Polly. "She hasn't long with us, and what she gets from you will help her where she's going," Amos said. Because the tall old man, with his keen eyes and fine carriage, could not be gainsaid, the teacher agreed to keep Polly. He wondered, as he watched the tanner go on his way, who would have the girl another year, and he thought she would nowhere find the kindness she had in the Fortune home. Soon Polly could not raise herself from her bed, but the weaker she grew, the more she smiled, as if a kind of content were coming over her being. Celindia spent hours reading to her, talking with her. Violet brought her things to eat. Amos sat beside her through the long, quiet evenings. Polly asked him for stories, and he told them to her. But more than all the others, she asked for the story of the chariot. After he had told it, they would sing together, her voice following his, even though she could only whisper the words. Violet, sitting across the room at the loom, and Celindia with the spindle in her hand, would join in. One night early in November, Polly asked Amos to help her sit up. He put his arms around her and held her up. She was so light that he felt if she held a flower on its stalk, it would be no heavier. She held out her hands, resting her right hand in Violet's, that were worn and coarse with the care she had given to others, and her left hand in Celindia's, that were supple and strong. Her eyes she kept on Amos. Peace dwelt in her face, a smile hovered over her lips, and for the first time she seemed to be seeing clearly those who were close to her. Her gaze that had always been so far away had come near at last. A small shudder passed over her body. She sat up very straight for a moment, even without the aid of Amos's arms, then she fell back into his arms. Celindia started to sob softly. Amos put back his head, and Violet saw him shape with his lips the familiar words, "Thank you, Lord." Violet turned to him with a question in her eyes. Amos answered it. "I wanted her to die free. I knew she didn't have long when I bit on her, but she's had almost a year of freedom." "She wasn't ever a slave," Violet reminded him. "She was born free." He shook his head. "She wasn't free when she was poor. She's gone ahead now with a smile on her face and a light in her eyes. Frightened little girl that she was, she's left that far behind and she's crossing Jordan unafraid." His face was glowing, almost as if he were sharing some of the radiance he knew had reached out to encircle Polly. Violet looked at him. Never before had she felt so much love for this man who seemed to give freedom to others. "You'd set all the world free if you could, wouldn't you, Amos?" He shook his head. "Just the part of it that I can touch. That's all any man can do." He drew a coverlet over Polly's face and reached across the bed to touch Celindia's hands. "Don't you cry, Lydia. You go out and give the creatures in the barn an armful of hay. Tell them what's happened in the house and see if the barn is shut tight, for the wind is blowing cold." Glad to have something to do, Celindia left the room. Amos went to the fire to put on more wood. Then, turning around, he spoke quietly to Violet. "Once, long years ago, I thought I could set a canoe load of my people free by breaking the bands at my wrists and killing the white man who held the weapons. I had the strength in my hands to do such a deed, and I had the fire within, but I didn't do it." "What held you back?" Amos shook his head. "My hand was restrained, and I'm glad that it was, for the years between have shown me that it does a man no good to be free until he knows how to live, how to walk in step with God." "But Amos," Violet exclaimed, "look at the people to whom you've given freedom, Lily and Lydia, Celindia and me, and now you've set Polly free to die happy." "And go on living?" he reminded her gently. "How is it you're thinking of these things tonight?" she asked. "Never before have you told me about that canoe load of your people." "I used to see Africa in Polly's eyes," he said. "The past and its sorrows and all that was behind, but I've not seen what was ahead for us until just now. Perhaps I saw that in her eyes too. It's good, Violet. It will be worth the waiting for." The next day, Josiah's Carey dug a grave for Polly Perdue in the churchyard near the lot that Amos Fortune had reserved for himself. A few months later, at town meeting, it was vowed to pay Amos Fortune the £1.16 in full for keeping Polly Perdue, even though he had not had her all the year. Amos would not use the money for his own needs. Instead, he put it away in a separate place, saying to Violet that he had a mind to do something particular with it, and when he knew what it was, he would tell her.